You're listening to WERA LP Arlington 96.7 FM. Welcome to another episode of the world-famous award-winning Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, filmmaker, film festival director, film critic, and lover of film and TV. You can find all the back episodes and so much more at picturelockshow.com. The Rosebud Film Festival is hitting D.C. and Arlington, Virginia today and through the weekend, January 26th through 28th. It's finally here, folks. Be sure to go to rosebudfestival.org to get information on tickets and the films we'll be screening. I'm bringing the Rosebud-themed interviews to a close this week, but be sure to subscribe to the podcast because I've covered 5 hours worth of great interviews with filmmakers who are making it happen. I feel like the nuggets shelled out over the course of the interviews are not just film-related, but have life application to them as well, which was really awesome. This week on the show, I have director of Silent Sentinel, Joe Jakevich, director of The Sandman, Lauren Knapp, director of The Importance of Finding the Other, Marcy Frucci, and the director of Last of the Manson Girls, Lonnie Martin. This is a fun listen as these directors shared some insights I don't think you'll hear anywhere else. And that's all ahead on Picture Lock.
Hi, this is writer-director Jeannie Donahoe of Game, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
I've got the director, Joe Jakevich, on the line. Joe, welcome to Picture Lock.
Well, thank you.
My first question is, when did you first fall in love with film?
Well, about 5 years ago, I was in a local community theater production. The people involved in it said, we're doing this thing called the 48-hour film project. And that's a competition where you make where a team makes a movie in a weekend. I had never done anything with film before that, but it sounded like, and I came out of that weekend. The movie was pretty great, but I was blown away by the fact that you could make a movie in a weekend with a camera that I already owned, and I became obsessed. And ever since then, I've spent most of my free time and spare cash on film.
Wow. So, man, that's a really cool breaking in story. So that was, what was the name of the film?
Influenced. It was just a little horror movie. I played this evil cult leader, and I guess I'm the one who got pulled into the cult of filmmaking.
I guess so. But hey, that brings us to Silent Sentinel. If you could, just let the audience know what the film is about.
Sure. A little corner of history that is not much known is in 1917, as a group of women was fighting for the right to vote, they started putting on these protests outside the White House. And the White House was not too happy about this, and the authorities ended up arresting these women, putting them in jail, and really torturing them in prison. And this, the film is about one event that happened around that. When their leader was actually in prison, she had gone on a hunger strike to protest the treatment. She was being brutally force-fed regularly. She was held incommunicado. They were doing a psychological evaluation of her. They were thinking of having her committed because it was just crazy. They thought her obsession with getting the vote was just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. And she was held incommunicado, and one night one of her followers had to communicate with her to sort of figure out what they should be doing in her absence. And so she snuck out there by night, and sort of they had a little conference through the window of the prison. And it just so happened that the trip that she took to get to the prison, there was this big cemetery right next to the prison. So she went through the cemetery. So it was it's sort of playing with all of these sort of horror movie tropes of, you know, lone woman wandering through the cemetery at night, trying to keep away from being noticed by guards in this case, in order to meet up with a woman who is being held in prison and being considered a mad woman. Only this is something that really happened, and it was something that was done by the government.
Wow. So my question would be, how did you come across the material? Obviously, it's history, but like, how did you come across this story? And what made you decide that you wanted to tell it?
Well, that's an interesting story, too. Not Alice Paul, not the leader, not the story we're telling here, but a lot of the other women activists were taken to the Occoquan Workhouse, which is in Occoquan, Virginia, which has since become the Lorton Workhouse that was part of the D.C. prison system. And that, in turn, was closed down about 20 years ago and turned into an art space. So they have artist studios there and things. My wife is a studio artist, and she has a studio there. So she actually came across the story first. She stumbled across the story when she saw tour guides coming through, giving tours to tourists, talking about these stories. She became obsessed about them, painted a whole lot of paintings that was sort of inspired by those stories. And then I learned the stories from her, and then I became obsessed. And this particular incident that this particular movie is about, she actually painted a painting about it first.
Wow.
So basically, I stole the idea from my wife.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking to the man that understands that inspiration can be found everywhere and maybe stealing from the wife sometimes is okay, director of Silent Sentinel, Joe Jackiewicz. So, Joe, what's been the reception of the film thus far? Because I know you've been on the film festival circuit.
It's been very well received. The screenplay for it at first was, that was one of the finalists in the DC Short Screenplay Competition last year. That I made the film, actually 2 years ago now, I guess, in 2016. I made the film in late 2016, early 2017, and it's been in a few festivals now. It has been well received. There's a couple of scenes in there where I got gasps from the audience, so that's always nice.
Yeah, you know, that was going to be my next question. What is it that you want the audience to take away after seeing the film?
A deep and abiding respect for these women, a better understanding of the history of this. Most of all, the knowledge that you can have progress if you are willing to work hard for it and pay the price, but there is always price to pay to have progress. It's not easy.
You know, I find this really kind of fascinating and interesting, especially with the just political climate, especially in filmmaking right now with Time's Up and Me Too. I guess my question is kind of, you know, how important do you think that telling this story is, especially today in today's climate?
I think it's extremely important. And let me tell you a little anecdote about that. We're also working on a documentary about the similar subject. As part of that documentary, we decided we filmed last year at the Women's March back in January of last year. And we actually met a young girl, a teenage girl, who was carrying a sign that quoted one of those signs that the suffragists carried in 1917. It was so thrilling to see that sign in the crowd and then to go talk to her.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the director of Silent Sentinel, Joe Jackiewicz. Joe, kind of wrapping up here, how can people follow the film, find out more about it online or social media?
I do have a website, crimesoftheart.com, and there's a big link to a page with more information about the film at the top of that website, and including a trailer.
And can I tell you that Crimes of the Art is like one of the dopest names? I love it.
Thanks. I actually grabbed the domain. I was trying to persuade my wife, who has a studio in a former prison, to use it for her studio, but I couldn't persuade her. So when I started getting into films, I decided I was going to use it.
Nice. Yeah, that is a little bit on the nose. I probably wouldn't have done that either. That's funny. All right, Joe. So, again, folks, you can come and see Silent Sentinel at the Rosebud Film Festival, January 26th through the 28th. Joe, I'm looking forward to seeing you there. Congratulations on creating a film because, you know, first and foremost, just making a film is tough work. And you've done it, and it's doing well on the circuit. So, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's great talking to you.
Hey, this is Paige Goldberg-Tolmack, director of What Haunts Us, and you are listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and a doctor walks the line of his own morality as he participates in executions while personally opposing capital punishment in the film The Sandman. I have the director of the film, Lauren Knapp, on the line. Lauren, welcome to Picture Lock.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. First question I always start out with, when did you first fall in love with film?
I can remember loving documentaries growing up, and especially when I was in high school. It was, I always felt like I was sort of being productive when I watched a documentary film. But it was, I think, when I really started to develop my love for nonfiction storytelling, it was through radio. And I, right after college, I lived in China for a year, and I started listening to This American Life and some other radio documentary podcasts as a way to, you know, just like when I was commuting on the bus and whatnot. But it was also a way for me to stay connected to the U.S. in kind of a more intimate way. And I just fell in love with the idea of telling true stories and looking for, you know, real life characters and how that sort of the richness that we all experience in our day to day life and how you can use art to really bring that to into focus.
Man, that is so interesting. Like going from radio and the spoken word, right? And I listening to some podcasts that I listen to, you know, there's one guy that always says, listen, audio storytelling is never going to go anywhere. That's what we had before we had a film camera. And mm-hmm. So being able to translate, you know, those stories and then bring it to life visually, that's really cool. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, radio is definitely my first love. And I got into video because I couldn't get a job in radio. but I ended up working for the PBS NewsHour, which was a wonderful job, and I loved it. And then I started to also fall in love with the visual medium and the very different style of storytelling and how you can rely on different kind of visual cues. And then the marriage of audio and visual to really tell an emotional and rich story.
Yeah, man, this is really cool because I can't wait to kind of get into the film. So if you could just let the audience know what the film is all about.
Yeah, so The Sandman is a portrait of a doctor who works in Atlanta, Georgia, and he provides, he's the owner of a private healthcare company that provides healthcare within the prison system in Georgia and a few other states. And about 15 years ago now, he became the head of the medical team for executions in the state of Georgia. So most of the states that have lethal injection also require a doctor to be at the execution in some capacity, and it varies by state. But in Georgia, there's a team of a couple nurses and a couple doctors, and his job is to oversee the medical team to make sure that they are properly, you know, inserting the IV and then to pronounce death and to intervene if something goes wrong. And so this is a look at this doctor's kind of moral confusion in a way, because he's personally opposed to capital punishment, and the medical industry is also very clearly against the use of medicine and the role of doctors in executions. They believe it goes against what medicine is all about. And so he's sort of in the middle of this contradiction. And I was interested in what it means to be in that space and how he navigates it.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with director Lauren Knapp of The Sandman, which you can see at the Rosebud Film Festival, January 26th through the 28th. Lauren, this is really interesting to me because I think one of the great things about the documentary is the way that you're able to kind of tell the story, step back, and just allow the viewer to kind of come to their conclusions while we're watching him wrestle with his own morality. One question I do have is, it's maybe a two-pronged question. How did you come across the material, quote-unquote, for the documentary? But then also, what was your decision-making in terms of telling the story so that it's, I hate to say fair and unbiased, but so this is a fair telling of his story.
Mm-hmm. So to answer your first question, I became really interested in the role of medicine and executions in 2015. It was right after there's a Supreme Court case that was decided a few days after the decision to legalize same-sex marriage. And so it didn't really get much attention because everyone was talking about the previous decision. But this had to do with lethal injection in Missouri and the use of drugs in that case. And what I found so interesting about it was how there's like really no science involved, because, you know, with medicine, it's all based on trials and experiments, and there's no experimentation and no scientific method involved in the use of lethal injection and executions. And so it's sort of using this, you know, medicine in a way that is not intended for. And so there's just this inherent contradiction right there. And so then I became really interested in the people that are involved in that and the physicians specifically. And I just manically searched for somebody, because most of the people that are involved are anonymous. The state protects their identity. So it's difficult to find anyone's name. But Dr. Musso, who's the character in this film, he had been public about his involvement years ago and was even interviewed by Dr. Atul Gawande in 2005 in a medical journal. And so I found him through that, and he agreed to work with me on this. And then, sorry, to answer your second question, it was about sort of the visual approach or the storytelling approach.
Mm-hmm. Just telling this the story and just allowing us to kind of observe and absorb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that was your takeaway, because that was definitely something I was very much trying to do. I think it's much more powerful and much more interesting for audiences to be presented with information and then to, you know, wrestle with their own personal like stereotypes or preconceived notions, especially with such a hot button issue and polarizing issue as capital punishment. And then use that information to really kind of check their own biases and come to a more maybe nuanced point of view. And so I worked really hard to not be too prescriptive in telling the audience what to think, because I think it sticks with you more when you can make those connections on your own. And I think that if you're able to challenge your biases, whether you come in, you know, completely against capital punishment or completely for it, I think no matter where you're coming from, this film provides an opportunity for you to think about it in a slightly different way and hopefully have a fuller picture.
Yeah, you know, I just want to tell you, you're really intelligent. And I just love the fact that, like, as a film critic, right? So I study and dissect film. I think as a film critic, and I went to school for film, but you know, the things that you just spoke about, like, they stand out to me as I watch the film. Like, I know the difference between someone that's like just putting the film together and kind of presenting everything versus someone who is being very thoughtful in their approach to the film and filmmaking. So, yeah, this is just really fun just talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. I can tell you that it's, you know, the editing process for documentaries is so interesting, because you really like, that's where a film can really be made. And I probably edited six different versions of this film. You know,
that's another smart point to bring up. You know, let people see it before you actually put it out there to the public. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, these doctors go anonymous. There's someone that I know that worked in the prison system as a physician for a long time, and there was one execution that he just had to call, you know, time of death on, and he doesn't really talk about it because, you know, I mean, you're there for somebody to be executed. But yeah, it's definitely something that, like, you don't really talk too much about, but I can see how, like, that just, it can be haunting for the person that has to do it, and it's kind of your job, quote unquote. But then at the same time, kind of stepping aside to be able to do it in your own personal conviction. So I think it's a really interesting story that people can definitely relate to. If you could, let people know how they can follow the film or find you on social media.
Yeah, you can go to the website, which is sandman-film.com. And then there's a Facebook page at The Sandman Film, I think. The Sandman Film on Facebook. And that's the best way to find it.
Awesome. So, Lauren, last question just to wrap things out. What is it that you hope people take away after seeing the film?
I honestly hope that it provokes a nuanced conversation. I think with something like capital punishment, it just, people have usually pretty fully developed ideas, and it can be difficult to have a conversation that exists in that sort of gray area. And I hope that this provides a new kind of insight that allows people to open up and discuss something that I think is a really important issue in our society.
Most definitely. Director Lauren Knapp of The Sandman, thank you so much for coming on Picture Lock.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break for promos. Stay tuned. What's up, guys? Thank you so much for listening to and supporting Picture Lock. I absolutely love film, as you know, and have given my life to studying the medium. As a filmmaker, I understand what it takes to make a film from its inception to the big screen. As a critic, I've been able to see the business of film from the marketing side of things. And as a film festival director, I've been able to see the distribution side, but more importantly, the enormous amount of talented filmmakers out there creating and crafting stories from their heart. And that's why I've started PictureLock PR. If you're a filmmaker or producer looking to engage audiences and create relevance around your latest or upcoming project, head over to picturelockpr.com. We can help you with your film's publicity from pre to post-production. Get more information and see the clients we've helped in the past at picturelockpr.com. PictureLock PR, finally, a partner as passionate as you.
Hi, I'm Dean Rogers with TheRogersReview.com, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and Footprints in the Sand is a comedic web series chronicling the misadventures of an inept Brooklyn theater company as they attempt to stage a production of King Lear and achieve internet stardom. You can check out episode 3, Inside Lear, at the Rosebud Film Festival this January 26th through 28th. I have the co-writer and star Jacob Boshri and director Jeff Johnson on the line with me. Guys, welcome to Picture Lock.
Hey, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. So the first question I always start out with is, when did you first fall in love with film?
Jacob, you want to go first? Or
I think you should go first.
Sure, that makes sense. So, man, I think way back in the day, I think my earliest memory probably of deciding that I love film was when my father gave me my first 35 millimeter kind of still camera. It was an old Canon FTB. I think I was like around 11 or 12. And I just fell in love with taking pictures, which kind of evolved when I went into high school into like making skateboard videos with my friends.
Nice.
Very cool. So for me, I think what's interesting is like, I think I really love theater. And me and I co-wrote this with two of the other actors in the show, Raven Pearson and Julia Doolittle, and all of us are kind of like theater people. And I think what was interesting to us was the weird reality that like theater kind of exists outside of mainstream culture in a lot of ways. And so we were just interested in the idea that like these people still want a lot of attention and want a way to be found and seen by everyone. So I think for us, actually, like the fun of this and like the fun of collaborating with Jeff on it was bringing like our perspective on theater into a process that was actually more about film and collaborating with somebody who was a really, really passionate filmmaker. So I guess I would say that I like film like as a viewer, but I think for me, yeah, my way into this is really through being a huge theater nerd.
I love it. So I always like to hear just breaking in stories. So Jeff, if you could just kind of like, how did you just really kind of break into the industry in regard to film? And Jacob, maybe you more so with theater.
Yeah, I think my history, again, you know, starting where I left off, was in making skateboard videos with my friends, which, you know, I never thought could become anything more than just, you know, having a good time with my buddies. But when I went into college, you know, I invested in, you know, seeking a degree in film, and it's a long road. And I guess I would say like I kind of went through like a process where I started by doing, I've got like a really big history in documentary filmmaking, and particularly as like a camera operator. And it just as my network grew, so did my opportunities.
Gotcha. I mean, I think that's always awesome. When the little things that you're doing as a kid, you just really don't realize that later on it's going to pay off in terms of, hey, I'm actually passionate about this. I think that's really cool.
Totally. I started really as an actor as a kid. I was like in a lot of plays and like community theater and school plays and like a little bit of professional theater. And then I studied acting in college and actually really transitioned a lot more towards theater directing. Like I would say a lot of my time in my life now is spent in the pursuit of a career of a theater director. And that transition for me really came from just reaching out to directors I had worked with as an actor and like finding ways to be their assistant. And I still assist a lot of directors. And so, yeah, I mean, I think similarly to Jeff, it's like you do something a lot as a kid, and then slowly but surely just the relationships you've formed and the opportunities you've made for yourself can expand outward. And you can begin to conceive of how you might make that into a career, but it is all very, very slow and incremental. And it can be hard to see the bigger picture when you're right in the middle of it, I would say.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're listening to Picture Lock on WERA 96.7 FM. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I have the gentleman from Footprints in the Sand, a comedic web series, director Jeff Johnson, and co-writer and star Jacob Bossery. Guys, let's go ahead and get into, I think we can kind of go at large, Footprints in the Sand, but then Inside Lear is the actual webisode that's going to be playing at the Rosebud Film Festival. So if you could just kind of let the audience know what the concept of the web series is, and then specifically the episode.
Jeff, you want to take it?
I think you should, Jacob. I think sure, because you're sure. The writer, I think you will nail this out of the park.
Totally. So Footprints in the Sand is about a really, really bad post-college theater company that attempts to achieve internet fame by documenting their process for making a really bad production of King Lear. And King Lear is like famously a Shakespeare play that shouldn't really be put on by young people. Like it's a huge component of it involves aging, and like at the center of the play is an old man, and so they really have no business taking it on at all, but sort of alongside it is just their desire to be seen and appreciated, and just the idea that some people become really famous overnight by documenting things online, and they want a piece of that. And so the show is really them making promotional videos. Like every episode is a promotional video for this hypothetical production. And they are initially trying to set it during a circus, and that doesn't work out. So they end up setting King Lear during the Civil War. and their ineptitude comes through, even though they are attempting to look professional and interesting. And the episode itself, the Inside Lear episode, is about, it takes place right after their auditions for their production, and you are first introduced to two new actors that they cast in the play. One of them is the man who will play King Lear, who is not nearly old enough, but he's older than them. Like, he's the sort of inappropriately, like, you're like, why is this adult hanging out with all of these recent college graduates?
Like, ambiguously old. Like, you can't really define his age.
Yeah, and he gives a really, he delivers a monologue that's like a little inappropriate and like a little misogynistic, and you can't quite tell what's going on, but they're really impressed by it because it seems kind of aggressive. and then they cast somebody who's drunk, but they find attractive, essentially. And then you spend the rest of the episode really just observing the chaos of their rehearsal room. And like, hopefully you just always see them being slightly crushed by the weight of this undertaking that they really can't handle.
Right. So, you know, Jeff, maybe you could answer this question in terms of like capturing the theater, because I definitely feel that because of, you know, Jacob being immersed in theater, you can tell that you're actually capturing what goes on behind the scenes. And I think that's one thing for most of us that just attend theater, right? We just get to see, you know, we don't break the fourth wall, but this is kind of like showing us the behind the scenes. What went into the process of making sure that you were able to bring the writing to life and capturing it in an authentic way?
That's a great question. And this episode in particular, I think, is a great example of what we did in regards of bringing the theater into film. And specifically, there's a scene in it where Neil is doing a stand-up. And like, let me back up for one second. Like, the stylistic choice we made for the whole series was to give it like this like mockumentary or like kind of office vibe, you know, where we're following the characters around in like a documentary style.
Right.
And so we go into this stand-up with one of the characters, and I'll say, like, I won't get into the details of what happens in the scene, but essentially it was all shot in a single shot. And the only way that we could do that was through like a pretty complicated character blocking that I feel like, because all the whole cast had this like awesome theater experience, it was not an issue at all to try something like that. Like, originally that scene was something like 7 or 8 shots. And because of time constraints and other miscellaneous things, we decided we could save a lot of time if we could do it in a single shot. And we just went for it. And it turned out really beautiful.
Yeah, man, it's always amazing how those things happen. You know, everybody says that 90% of filmmaking is responding to issues on the set, and something beautiful like that can come out of it. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with co-writer and star Jacob Boshry and director Jeff Johnson of Footprints in the Sand. Guys, unfortunately, we're going to kind of have to wrap things out here, but, you know, how can people follow the series online and social media?
Well, they can find us on Instagram. If they just look up Footprints in the Sand web series, they should be able to find it. And it's also on YouTube. And the YouTube channel is linked to the Instagram. And you can also find us on Facebook if you also search Footprints in the Sand web series.
You know, I was just thinking about this. Does Footprints in the Sand have to do, like, you know, have you seen that old picture? I know my parents had it up in the house, like, in the 80s. It was, like, Footprints in the Sand, and it has, like, two front footprints, and it's, like, this conversation with God. And is that what that's...
the Bible reference?
Yeah.
I think what it really has to do with is that there's just, like, no good name for a theater company. Like, it's impossible. And so we tried to pick something that... seemed like a metaphor that might be kind of broad. Like, is it a religious association? Is it an accident? I think it's meant to describe like the overall ineptitude of the entire endeavor combined with their attempt at this being important. Like they're going to try and create like a great piece of art, but it's actually just confusing, I think, is most of what ends up happening in the show.
Right. Awesome. Well, guys, I really appreciate talking with you. This was far too short. We'll have to talk more again later. But yeah, good luck in your festival runs. It's really a hilarious web series.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, everyone. This is Danielle Vega, a.k.a. Ceci, of Hulu's original series, East Los High, and you are tuned in to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and the importance of finding the other is the story of a young biracial girl named Iris who sets out to discover what it means to be an other. Along the way, she encounters a pair of immigrants, a homeless veteran, and a transgender female who all bring some piece of the definition to light. I have the writer, director, producer, Marcy Frucci on the line. Marcy, welcome to Picture Lock.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I really love this short film, and so I can't wait to get into it. But the first question I always start out with is, when did you first fall in love with film?
So I've always loved watching films. My first experience actually getting to make them was as a 14-year-old in high school. And I had the pleasure of taking part of a high school program in Hawaii called MiniMac, which was media and communications. So that's kind of my first foray into the wonderful world of what you can do with a video camera. So for me, I really fell in love with how you can visually and orally tell a story and kind of show your unique perspective to the world by kind of, you know, manipulating and showing people what you see through the lens of a camera. So I only spent a year there because my family was in the military, so we moved around a lot. By the time it stuck with me. So by the time I was a senior in high school, I was kind of one of my goals was to go to film school. And so I kind of pursued that. And basically, like, it just became my life. Every time I have something that I want to express or need to tell, I always kind of turn to that video camera. So I've had a long journey of picking up a camera to tell a story from my perspective.
You know, I can totally relate to that. For me, I feel like when you pick up a camera and you tell your story, right, like there are certain ways that you can be expressive through film that, you know, like you might get upset and you can fake a fight scene, right? But you're not actually doing it in real life. And then at the same time, like maybe to emote empathy for a subject, you can tell that through the lens. So I totally get where you're coming from. That makes tons of sense. If you could, I love hearing breaking in stories. How did you kind of get started in the industry?
So again, my biggest gateway was through school, through college. I spent a year at USC and then I finished, I guess, at State University and started doing, actually worked in TV news for a while. But I was kind of doing independent projects on the side. And so I've really been an independent filmmaker for a very long time. My kind of entryway into narrative filmmaking happened more as I got older and, you know, I wanted to kind of explore more of a, you know, large scale production storytelling. So I went back to USC for my master's in film producing. And when you're kind of thrown in that environment, you make movies. Like that's what you have to do for school. That's what you do on the side, that you just kind of get into the industry that way. And I really fell in love with freelance work and getting to kind of work on different projects and get to pick kind of my projects. So I carried on moving around a lot through my adult life. So I would do projects all over the world. And then when I came back here to DC, it's always kind of finding that community of filmmakers is so crucial to getting any kind of project off the ground. So I started kind of trying to create content and finding kind of people to work with who are equally passionate to kind of put things out there. So kind of just how I got into it is through school and then just through the passion of wanting to make films. So,
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the writer-director of The Importance of Finding the Other, Marcy Frucci. Marcy, you know, I want to get into the film because I think that it tells a special story. And not only that, the way that you did it, it's there's a lot of care that went into the way that you told it. So if you could let the audience know what the film is about and then what inspired you to make it.
Right. So the film is kind of a journey of self-discovery. It focuses on a young kind of biracial girl who is forced at first with a school form trying to kind of choose what race she is. And this is kind of an older, I took it from my own kind of experience, it's an older school form where you had to choose one. And she is, you know, an Asian father and a Caucasian mother. So trying to rectify what she choose throws her into kind of the first idea of other. Her mother throws out that, well, you can always just choose other. So she goes on this journey, basically, of trying to understand what is an other. As most, I think, children today and teenagers today do, they like turn to Siri, ask a question, and you find that definition, and then she goes on this journey to kind of find others. And I wanted to kind of explore different versions of what an other is. We as a society, I feel like try to classify each other and divide and kind of put people in categories. So I wanted to explore kind of different categories that we kind of try to separate each other from. So she finds a pair of immigrants who are, you know, who run a business called The Other Mary Mays because they're different. And then she finds, you know, she encounters a homeless, a veteran who, you know, chooses not to live a traditional way of life. And then, you know, at the end on the bus, she kind of encounters a transgender female who kind of helps her bring it all together, helps her realize that everybody is different. No two people are the same. So everybody's another. Just we try so hard to find, you know, our likes and who's like me and who can I identify with. But sometimes we don't appreciate how we're all so very different. And that's a different isn't a bad thing. So for me personally, this is rooted in my own struggles with identity. I'm biracial myself and struggled a long time with kind of rectifying where did I belong? You know, who do I fit in with? And to top it all off, I moved around a lot. So I was never kind of in one place all the time. So when I was filling out job applications when I came back to DC, I was, you know, the form asks you different things. One of the things was gender, and there was male, female, other. And so it was one of those times when I was like, there's that word again. And it made me, it like brought all these bad feelings back, all these like feelings of struggle. And I just, my kind of heart went out to people who, you know, had to kind of make choices again. And so for me, I realized, why is it a bad thing, right? Why is being different? Why do we put a negative light on the word other? Why is it bad to be different? Why is it not embraced? So I kind of wanted to explore that and paint people as people. And so that's kind of what this journey in this film led to.
Man, well said. You know, I one thing that I was thinking of, you know, just kind of taking us as an audience through this journey, through the eyes of an innocent girl, was that part of your thought process? Because I think sometimes when we tackle, you know, maybe hot button issues, and that it's always important to kind of do it in a way in which, you know, it's universal. And I think, you know, it, like the little moment with her asking Siri about it, which one I think is really cool because like this day and age, it kind of this is technology and how it kind of would work now versus maybe, I don't know, what would we look it up in an Encyclopedia Britannica back in the day or something. But like little light nuanced touches like that. But then also allowing us to kind of have our eyes in, be this little girl. Was that part of your thinking?
Yes. There definitely was. For me, I think whenever you look at something through the eyes of a child, they're inherently curious, right? They're forming their opinions. They're kind of learning things as they go. And so they're, I think, more open to possibilities and differences. And it's less of, you know, having already had a prejudgment, right? So she definitely kind of wanted to do it through the eyes of a child, through the eyes of someone who was you know, totally unbiased and just wanted to learn and experience and questioning what this word is, questioning what this does, what does this definition mean? What are you trying to tell me? You know, so it was definitely an intentional choice on my part.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, sometimes children are so honest. I have a 3- and a 5-year-old, and so, like you said, they're forming their own opinions. They're questioning things to figure out, like, honestly. Sometimes I'm like, would you just, I know what you just said or asked. You didn't mean to be disrespectful, but the way that you said it, it was. But they're just, like, brutally honest, you know, about, like, what they're trying to find out. And it's totally innocent in the way that they're doing it. So I think it's just a brilliant idea to allow her to be kind of our the bus ride into this yeah. whole situation. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the writer-director of The Importance of Finding the Other, Marcy Frutri. Marcy, unfortunately, we kind of got to bring this interview to a close, but I definitely want to have you back on so we can talk about this a little bit more. But how can people follow the film online and social media?
So we have a website. It's findtheother.wordpress.com. And then I'm on Facebook as well. We're at Find the Other. Those are kind of our handles. So you can definitely look us up both of those ways. And then come out and check Rosewood Film Festival. We'll be showing our film on Friday, the 26th. So.
Most definitely. I appreciate that plug at the end. One question I do have is, you know, what are your plans for the film post festival and post, you know, outside of the film festival circuit? Because I definitely think it's a good entryway into just kind of addressing, you know, things like the other and, you know, what that means. Are you doing anything like with education with it?
So that's one of the things I definitely want to explore post-festival run. I want to put it out there on the internet. Amazon has a great kind of short film entry point now as well. And I want to put it out there. We had our premiere at LACMA, the Los Angeles Museum of Art. And so I definitely want to kind of try and find a way to get it out into more educational venues to kind of open up that discussion of race and differences and how we classify each other and kind of understanding that we're all part of the world and we're all unique and special. And, you know, it should be, differences should be valued and not mean to be negative. So.
And that's
definitely, hope to see that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's definitely a message that comes through in The Importance of Finding the Other. Writer, director, producer, Marcy Frutri, thank you so much for coming on Picture Lock, and I wish you continued success with the film.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and in the film, Last of the Manson Girls, convinced there's more to the Manson murders than meets the public eye, counterculture journalist Paul Krasner embarks on an LSD-tinged investigation of the last of Manson's disciples, Brenda McCann, Sandra Good, and Lynette Squeaky Fromm. What he finds could change how the world sees the 60s. If he lives long enough to tell the story. I have the writer-director of the film, Lonnie Martin, on the line. Lonnie, welcome to Picture Lock.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's my pleasure, man. First question that I always start out with is, when did you first fall in love with film?
I'm going to give you such a cliche answer. I mean, Star Wars, right?
I haven't definitely heard that before on the show. That's okay, though.
I mean, it just changed, you know, changed my life, right? And, you know, when I was older, I certainly got into sort of film as an art form, sort of appreciating it that way. But I mean, even, you know, just from a young age, you know, I loved movies. I was fascinated by how they were made. And it's no surprise that I ended up making them myself.
Totally makes sense. And like I said, you know, Star Wars is one of those, like, before Star Wars and after Star Wars in terms of cinema. So, you know, you can't, it's cliche, but you can't go wrong with that.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly, you know.
All right, man. So if you could just kind of tell us your breaking in story. How did you get started in the industry?
I started out doing indie film as like an extra actor. So I'd written some scripts for the stage, and I started writing screenplays, and I was interested in filmmaking. And as part of that process, I was doing like background work and actor work, like indie stuff. And through that, I just sort of met other indie filmmakers here in DC in the DMV. And from there, started working on a couple sets as like an assistant and stuff. And then finally, in 2005, I made my first short film. And from there, I kind of did a couple 48-hour film projects, right? And what happened to me was people, you know, some of the people that I had gotten to work on my short films worked professionally in the area. And they would say, hey, we need a guy to come be an assistant. We need a guy to come be a grip, help with lights. And I started picking up these freelance jobs in town. And then I had another job. And then 5 years ago, that job sort of went away. And I was like, well, what if I try to freelance full time? And I did. And, you know, recently I went back to get my master's degree, and I got it in film electronic media and got the formal training kind of after I had gotten the on the job training. And yeah, I mean, I continue to make films for clients in the area, but I also continue to make my own stuff, short films, web series, and of course now the feature.
That's pretty awesome. Man, you're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the writer-director of Last of the Manson Girls, Lonnie Martin, the guy that understands how to navigate freelance waters into a feature film, which brings me to my next question. Lonnie, if you could, just let the audience know what the film is all about and kind of what inspired it. I know I hit it in the intro, but still. What's the film all about, and what inspired you to make this?
Sure. So Paul Krassner was a counterculture journalist in the 60s. It was a satirist. He did a magazine called The Realist. It was like a proto Onion, very mad magazine, very, very political. And he was friends with Lenny Bruce. He was part of that sort of underground comedy scene, part of the protest movement, the anti-war and civil rights protest movement, and was a part of the Yippies who organized the protest at the 68 Democratic Convention. He, as an essayist, he started to explore the Manson murders as a possible CIA conspiracy to delegitimize the youth movement. And through that, he wrote an essay called My Acid Trip to Squeaky Prom that told the story of how he hung out with three of the Manson girls and took LSD and hung out with him for the day. And it's a very thin sort of journalistic, you know, observatory piece. And I've been trying to crack sort of a Squeaky Fromm script for a while at that point. And when I found his essay, I was like, you know, I think maybe instead of her being the main character, what if he's this character and we sort of experience them through his eyes? And a lot of the ideas I was trying to express started to work on that when I approached from that level. And I contacted Krassner. He's still alive. He's in his 80s, lives out in Southern California. And I was like, hey, I think I'd like to make a film out of this. And he was like, sure, send me a copy. And I've kept, you know, he and I have corresponded a lot during the process of making it. But I got the rights, and then started making the movie.
Yo, that is really cool. I didn't realize that you actually got the rights, and I guess, you know, that would make sense that you would have to do that, but still, that's awesome.
It's it's part of it.
I hear you. All right, so I've been checking out some of the behind the scenes photos and everything. You built a set to actually shoot this?
I did. So I was a theater major, and I used to work as a set carpenter locally when I, you know, working all kinds of odd jobs. And I just had a set background. I took a drafting class in college, and like I just knew how to draft set plans. And so, you know, it's really kind of hard to have a low budget period piece in the 70s is not, you know, it's not easy to pull off. It's hard to find locations. And we're just really having trouble finding a location for the main apartment where a lot of the action takes place. And I just sort of got it in my head. I was like, yeah, we could build something. And I called in a ton of favors. And we got a space. And we built a set. We built for about a week. And then we shot over the course of 2 weeks. We had two sets, actually, that we built because we had the apartment, the kitchen, and the living room, and then we tore that down, put up the bathroom set, and shot in the bathroom. And actually, one of the other scenes in the movie is also a partial set the office, Paul's office. There's a, the window is just a wall with a light behind it, you know?
Man, so. Getting it done. I love it, man. That is awesome. I mean, because, you know, that's one of the things about filmmaking in general, right? They say, like, don't do period pieces because it, you know, costs so much. But, I mean, when you're able to put your skills to the test like that and, you know, create a set, that's really hats off to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, I've found that we don't have, you know, a lot of filmmakers don't have money, and so we have to use what I call sweat equity, right? You have to sort of like, you're going to commit, if you don't have the money, you're going to commit a lot more time and a lot more energy. And it's good that I had a background in set design and building sets, and friends that would come out and help me for pizza and beer and help me build it. And so and a great art director, a great Gilda Siomaz is the art director, and she's kind of what brought it all to life.
Nice. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the writer-director of Last of the Manson Girls, which is going to be closing out the Rosebud Film Festival in our closing night feature. It's actually going to be a world premiere. Am I right, Lonnie?
Yeah, you are correct. Yeah, you are correct. The first time it's going to be have been seen anywhere.
That's an exciting thing. So, folks, you're going to have to come on out and check out the film. Lonnie, obviously, you're not able to tell like what the reception has been thus far, but in terms of like a big audience. But you know, what has the reception been in terms of like people that have seen kind of the fine cuts and stuff like that?
I mean, it's been pretty good. So this was my thesis film for my master's degree at American University. And I had a screening, an early screening of a rough cut, and it went over well. But what I found was in the original cut, we sort of just jumped right in. We sort of assumed a little bit of knowledge about Charles Manson and the murders. And what I found out, you know, it's not part of the cultural zeitgeist anymore. And that people in there, you know, young folks in their 20s and even they're not as familiar with sort of the Manson phenomenon. So I mean, you know, I had to go back and sort of contextualize that in the 60s and the protest movement, sort of the times we live in, and they're not altogether different from the times we live in now. So it was a little bit easy to find points of reference.
Man.
But yeah, it's been the response. People seem to like it. I've been working on it for 3 years. I've been looking at it so long, like I just don't. At this point, I need to just see it with an audience and see how if the things I think are funny get laughs, and if the things I think are exciting or excite an audience.
Right. No, I totally get it, and I appreciate that insight that you just kind of gave in terms of the film and working through some of those issues. That's pretty cool. So unfortunately, we got to wrap things out. How can people follow the film online, social media?
LastManSonGirl.com is the website, singular, LastManSonGirl.com. And from there, you can get to our Facebook, my Twitter, Instagram. There's a trailer there. And we haven't updated the site with screening info yet, but hopefully as it screens here, then we're hoping it'll screen in a couple other cities later this year. People will be able to find out if it's coming to a city near them.
Awesome. Writer, director of Last of the Manson Girls, Lonnie Martin. Appreciate you coming on Picture Lock.
Thanks so much.
That's all for this episode. I'd like to thank my guests, Joe Jakevich, Lauren Knapp, Marcy Frucci, and Lonnie Martin for coming on the show. If you enjoyed what you heard, be sure to go to rosebudfestival.org to get tickets and see the films at the Rosebud Film Festival this weekend, January 26th through the 28th, if you're in the D.C. area. You can find Picture Lock on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, Pinterest, and Periscope. All social media is at Picture Lock Show. Watch back episodes of the TV show at youtube.com/picturelockshow and subscribe to it to get some incredible value and see interviews with filmmakers and the like. You can download the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio and other places podcasts are downloaded. Feel free to give the show a hearty review if you're enjoying it. Interested in being a guest on the show? Of course you are. There's a form for that on the website as well. How has this show helped you? What's one of your favorite episodes? Send me an email and let me know at pitchlockshow@gmail.com. All music is done by Mike S. The Prophet 13. Thanks, bro. I'm Kevin Sampson, and until next time, I hope you stay locked on film.